That fast used to be cool, but not anymore.
American fast food, what a stupid way to die. American fast food, order me the jumbo fries.
Some cities are banning new fast food joints. Other cities are mandating calorie count posters, all to combat skyrocketing obesity rates. Should food be a personal decision or a question of public health? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, August 13th. I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. Good morning, Catherine.
Hey. Now, this morning, we're going to ride with John McCain in New Jersey, figure out why both he and Barack Obama have got Frank Sinatra under their skin, look at the shutdown of some crucial oil routes in the wake of Russia's conflict with Georgia. We're also going to get the latest from a BBC reporter in Tbilisi, Georgia. Plus, we're going to find out why we have to say goodbye to Olympic softball. That's all coming up this hour, but first, these headlines.
The BBC is reporting that Russian troops and their allies in the Republic of Georgia's breakaway region of South Ossetia have already broken a truce that was supposed to end fighting between Russia and Georgia. The BBC's Gavin Hewitt is on the ground in Gori.
There are still Russian tanks in the city. They seem to be dismantling and destroying Georgian army bases there. There is a pall of smoke over the market. We have heard of people being stripped of everything at gunpoint. There may well be a ceasefire, but terror has come in its wake.
Hewitt says a stream of people from smaller villages outside Gori are reporting that their houses have been torched. Russia denies that its troops have broken the truce. While the situation in Georgia remains on edge, diplomatic fallout continues following Russia's invasion of the independent state. Senior Bush administration officials say the U.S. and allies are considering kicking Russia out of the G8 group of industrialized nations.
In Afghanistan, a militant ambush south of Kabul has killed three women from a U.S. aid organization, an American, a Canadian, and an Irish national. The three worked for the aid group International Rescue Committee. The woman's Afghan driver was also killed. No one has claimed responsibility for a roadside bomb that tore through morning rush hour traffic in the Lebanese capital of Tripoli. 18 people, including 7 Lebanese soldiers, were killed and 40 more wounded.
U.S. swimmer Michael Phelps racked up 2 more gold medals, setting records in the 200-meter butterfly and the 800 freestyle relay. Teammate Aaron Pearsall says Phelps, well, he says he's an inspiration.
What Michael's doing, it's certainly elevating, I think, everybody else's performance here. And hopefully he can say the same thing about us.
Phelps has won more gold medals than any Olympic athlete in history.
Power-sharing talks between Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe and opposition figure Morgan Tsvangirai are at a standstill. South African President Thabo Mbeki is mediating the talks and says both men are still considering a deal. We want you to consider one of our takeaway questions today. Give us that presidential playlist. Go to 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. More coming up.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Catherine Lamper is in for John Hockenberry.
Hey, Adora.
Out today. And we're going to get to what's happening in the Republic of Georgia and the conflict between the Republic of Georgia and Russia in a moment. But we're going to begin with Pakistan, where some newspapers are reporting this morning that Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf will resign tomorrow on the country's Independence Day. Musharraf is perhaps battling the worst internal political crisis of his life, and members of his cabinet have launched an impeachment campaign, started last week and has gone through several incarnations in the last 5 days or so. Now, Musharraf has repeatedly stressed he will not resign, despite many calls for him to do so. For more on this, we go to Shazeb Jilian, who joins us from the BBC's Urdu service. Thanks so much for being with us, Shazeb. Hello? Can you hear us, Shazeb?
I can hear you now.
Most excellent. Where are these reports of Musharraf's plans to resign? Where are they coming from, and are those credible sources?
They're coming from Pakistani newspapers. The sources are unnamed. There's a lot of speculation in Pakistan that President Musharraf is thinking about resigning instead of facing the impeachment process. But really, it is no one can say with authority what he might do.
And it would certainly be a quick turnabout, because Musharraf has steadfastly said that he would not step down, and he has called the charges levied against him ridiculous. Do you want to start first with what those charges are?
Well, the ruling coalition of Pakistan People's Party and Pakistan Muslim League and two other parties, they are saying that President Musharraf has violated constitution. He has subverted the political system. He has not passed on the U.S. Assistance for war on terror to the army. So charges are very varied. I mean, they include from corruption to misconduct. But the presidency is maintaining that we have not seen the charges. The charge sheet has not been presented. And once it is, then the president will decide. He's been consulting his political allies, and they are saying that he should face the charges, and he should not resign.
We've also seen some polls. We've seen some polls showing that the majority of Pakistanis believe that Musharraf should indeed step down.
That's correct. President Musharraf is deeply unpopular. He has been unpopular for several years now, but it seems now that he has lost his supporters, not just politically, domestically, but remember, in Pakistan, army is the biggest stakeholder. And it seems that army is sort of standing on sidelines. Army has said it will not interfere in the parliamentary impeachment process, which some are interpreting as army not fully behind President Musharraf. Another big stakeholder in Pakistan's politics is the United States. And the U.S. has said that this is Pakistan's internal domestic issue. Whatever happens in Pakistan should be according to constitution. So a lot of people are interpreting that as a message that the U.S. does not want to side with President Musharraf. U.S. realizes that he is losing support, and the U.S. now needs to work with the new democratically elected government,
which is, of course, very fragile at this point. It is headed by two men who have themselves been accused of corruption.
In the past, yes. But remember, Asif Ali Zardari, husband of former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, he had a host of corruption charges and murder charges against him. All of them were waived according to an alleged deal between President Musharraf and Pakistan People's Party, which was brokered by the United States. The U.S. had a clear stake in seeing Musharraf continue while giving political space to political parties like People's Party. On Nawaz Sharif, yes, Nawaz Sharif was pardoned for a plane hijacking case. He was sent abroad in exile. Then he was allowed to come in, come back to the country under Saudi mediation. So these two leaders have faced exile and prison over the last one decade, but now they are firmly in charge of Pakistan's political scene. They have a good enough majority, and they are confident that if they go through with the impeachment process, they will get rid of Musharraf.
Shazab, this is Catherine Lanfer. You said they're firmly in charge of the political scene, but there are reports also that India is getting very uneasy about what's going on, simply because if you are trying to negotiate as a neighbor, even a neighbor you don't get along with, but trying to negotiate something like the contested region of Kashmir, who's in charge? Who are they supposed to talk to?
That's a good question. I mean, not just India, but think about Afghanistan. Think about Pakistan's secret intelligence agency, the ISI. Even though these politicians have been in the government for 4 months now, they recognize that as long as President Musharraf is there, Pakistan's intelligence agencies are not being controlled by the politicians, but by the presidency and by the army. So in Pakistan, whether it is India or Afghanistan, on both sides, they have been accusing ISI for creating trouble in their countries. And what these two leaders are saying
is that... Shazab, it's actually a little bit more than that, isn't that? I mean, the ISI is a notorious power broker in Pakistan politics and in the region.
Correct. That's certainly the reputation that ISI enjoys. What these two political leaders have been saying all along is that ISI needs to be answerable to the political leadership. It should not be indulging in covert operations dictated by the military. And that's what happened, remember, in the 80s when ISI was fighting the Afghan jihad. Money was being funneled through Saudi Arabia by the CIA, and jihad was okay back then. Mm-hmm. Now it is not. And ISI, a lot of people believe, needs to be brought under some kind of accountability.
Is there any significance about tomorrow being Pakistan's Independence Day? Would there be some significance of Musharraf potentially or allegedly, as it's been reported, planning to step down on that particular day?
It's very difficult to say, but tomorrow is a very interesting day. Like you said, it's Pakistan's Independence Day. It's August 14th. And typically, we see an official function in Islamabad where the president is there, the prime minister, the federal cabinet, and the armed services chiefs. But tomorrow, quite interestingly, we are likely to see two separate functions, one being held in the presidency, being led by Musharraf, and the prime minister and the cabinet holding a separate function. What will be very interesting to watch is where the army chief goes, and that might say a lot about where he stands.
Watching the body language tomorrow.
Yes.
Is there anything else on the calendar? I mean, it's quite late there, but are there any meetings that are being held that you're aware of? I mean, what's the next step procedurally in this movement to impeach Musharraf?
Well, the impeachment process has not begun yet. This week, what we have seen is Pakistan's four provincial assemblies passing a resolution that they have no confidence in President Musharraf. This does not have any legal or constitutional value, but it is a strong political message to Musharraf that Pakistan's provincial assemblies are not with him. Two of the assemblies passed their resolutions earlier this week. Today, the province of Sindh passed a resolution unanimously. We will see probably Balochistan, the fourth province, passing a resolution sometime this week.
Okay, Shazab Giuliani, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
He is an editor with the BBC's Urdu service, which broadcasts the BBC News in Pakistan.
Okay, Adora, I just have to turn to you. You have covered this country. We keep hearing that something's going to happen. I don't know how to read these tea leaves.
I don't think anyone does, which is so fascinating when we listen to somebody like Shazab or any of the other observers, the keen observers of what's happening in Pakistan.
What analogies do you see between the uncertainty in Pakistan and the uncertainty in the future of Zimbabwe? We keep getting the same sort of confusion coming out of both places.
Well, they're just developing stories would be my take on that. They're developing stories. In Zimbabwe, it's a question as to the process itself, the lack of transparency, the resistance to this Robert Mugabe regime.
But lack of transparency, don't they both have that in
common? Violence and so on. But in the Pakistan version, I mean, they actually have a set of constitutional rules that the coalition government is following and trying to impeach the substance of the allegations against Musharraf. Now, that's a separate question as to whether or not there is any validity to that. But right now, we're going to ask you if you could send a song to one of the presidential candidates to make it on their playlist. What song would that be?
Should have called a segue. Left turn there into music.
It was so smooth. So smooth. But we want to know, I mean, why do you think Barack Obama and John McCain have Frank Sinatra in common? Drop us a note at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I should say drop us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And then you can drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Or croon us a tune. We want to hear you sing. Yeah, baby.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning on this Wednesday, August 13. Catherine Lamper is in for John Hockenberry. And we're going to take a look at some politics now, and specifically at Senator John McCain and his team. They're making a serious run at New Jersey and its 15 electoral votes. That might be a real head-scratcher for those of you who know that the Garden State has not gone for a Republican presidential candidate since 1988. Polls show Senator Barack Obama has consistently been ahead of McCain by double digits, and Obama has also raised three times as much money there. Still, McCain may have a secret weapon. His campaign chief hails from New Jersey, and perhaps Scott Schmidt knows something the rest of us don't. WNYC's political reporter Bob Henley was with John and Cindy McCain last night. Good morning, Bob. Set the scene for us. What were the McCains up to in New Jersey yesterday?
Well, I think they wanted to do the typical ATM run through New Jersey, which is what both parties do, and kind of make it look like a campaign. So what do? You've got a candidate that needs to be in a lot of different places, so you send your wife to a New Jersey diner for a very short visit, and then you have the candidate himself kind of, let's put it this way, the Straight Talk Express, because I did cover John McCain back when he was allowed out in public like a person when he did his last run for president. And this time now it's like the bell jar local. He actually took no questions from reporters. And so Cindy McCain really fronted the campaign publicly in Red Bank down there in Monmouth County. And then she would join her husband later in the day up in Teaneck at a very tightly controlled fundraising event, which was held by a pro-Israeli group. And it was all very hush-hush. Actually felt like some kind of secret lodge, actually.
And so what do you think they are up to in New Jersey? What's the strategy here for a state that's consistently been blue for some time when it comes to picking presidents?
I think a part of it has to do with the fact that Barack Obama is on vacation after trying to run for being president of Europe. So the McCain campaign looks like they have themselves a kind of open field, and they've had a very good rhetorical run. Remember, it was Senator McCain who talked about offshore drilling. That was kind of a non-starter, and all of a sudden, Senator Barack Obama opened the door a little bit to it. Then Speaker Pelosi did. And so McCain was actually getting traction even in New Jersey. He has not just Stephen Schmidt, who was a protege of Karl Rove and a veteran of the Bush-Cheney years.
And running McCain's campaign now.
Right, but also he has Mike Duhaime from Passaic County. He's the political director.
New Jersey.
Exactly. Bill Stepien, the national field director, is also from Morris County. These guys are from like a 25-mile area within New Jersey. And the thing is, in the New York media market, they have to make it look like John McCain can at least do as well as President Bush's father did in 1988. And again, most importantly, make it look like he's Ronald Reagan incarnate. And they figure with what's happening right now in Russia, with the incursion into Georgia, this is John McCain's moment. Because remember, this is beautiful for them because McCain has been running to the right, more muscular approach, if you will, to George Bush, the present occupant of the White House, when it comes to this issue about Georgia. So, you know, he never said, as Bush, the current occupant of the White House, did, that he looked in Putin's eyes and saw something dreamy. No, John McCain knew that the Ruskies couldn't be trusted. And so that's resonating with the base. They figure they can put that together with the kind of maverick reputation that he has about occasionally being seen in public with Democrats like Feingold and Kennedy. And they can put together some kind of, well, crossover guy.
Well, and there are some real potential votes here, aren't there? I mean, we're talking about 2.2 million unaffiliated registered voters in New Jersey. Aren't they the voters that McCain and crew are going after?
Well, one of the things that happened, one of the silver linings, if you will, of that never-ending primary process between Barack Obama and Senator Hillary Clinton was Democrats came out of the woodwork. So you're right. Technically, political scientists define a swing state as if you take the Republicans and Democrats and add them together, If the number of independents is bigger than both combined, then you got yourself a swing state. Well, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton got so much energy going that 500,000 new Democrats signed up. So now there's 1.6 million freshly minted Democrats and 1 point something and change Republicans, meaning that technically it's not a swing state. You're right, the independents are the ballast, if you will. But the bottom line is, it seems the state is really fatigued with the war in Iraq. That kept coming up yesterday when we would interview people. You know, half our National Guard is over in Iraq and Afghanistan. The largest deployment since the Second World War. And that, and of all volunteer army, really wears when you get into your second and third deployment.
So who does that weigh towards, Obama or McCain?
I think at this point, at least, it weighs towards Obama. The bottom line here is that it's all about perception. So the Schmidt-Duhaime Stepien axis has to try to make it so that the Obama people think they've got a problem in New Jersey. And Duhaime is very bright in the sense that he was responsible back in 2004 when he headed the Northeast region for the Bush reelection effort. He kept the Democrats pinned down in Appalachian range. He kept them worrying about Pennsylvania, worrying about the entire Northeast corridor. In fact, John Edwards, we remember him. They even sent this guy into Hudson.
How could we forget him, Bob?
The hair alone. Never trust a guy with that kind of hair. The thing about it is that he came into Hudson County on the eve of the election because there was anxiety about the Northeast. So that's all they've got to do is keep the Obama people off their game. And I would imagine, I'd love to be a fly in the room over in Hawaii. I don't think there's much vacation going on. I think they're trying to say to him, like in the third round of Rocky, get your head back in the game. Because actually, from what I can see, they kind of lost the rhetorical edge, especially when they had to cede so much ground on offshore drilling.
Bob Henley, thank you. Bob is a WNYC political reporter, an excellent one at that. Now we turn to another excellent reporter, Femi Oke, who's got the latest headlines for us.
Thanks, Adoa. That's very sweet of you. 28 minutes past the hour. The BBC is reporting that Russian troops and their South Ossetian allies are rampaging through a key city in the breakaway province of South Ossetia. BBC correspondent Gavin Hewitt reports from the outskirts of the city of Gori.
We've spoken to so many terrified people who talk about running from their houses, turning around and seeing them being torched. And these are people giving first-hand accounts. And I can tell you, when you look into their faces and you hear their stories, you know they're telling you what they lived through.
Now, Russia says that it has not broken the truce. Diplomatic relations between Russia and the U.S. remain very icy. Senior Bush administration officials say that the U.S. and allies are considering kicking Russia out of the G8 group of industrialized nations. In Afghanistan, three women working for a U.S. aid organization are dead after being shot in a militant ambush south of Kabul. The three, an American, a Canadian and an Irish national, worked for the International Rescue Committee. Their Afghan driver was also killed. No one has claimed responsibility for a roadside bomb that tore through a civilian bus at a rush hour in the Lebanese capital Tripoli, killing 18 and wounding at least 40. Lebanese President Michel Suleiman is scheduled to visit Syria today in an attempt to repair relations between the neighbouring countries. And we do need a little bit of a bright spot after all of that news. And that
yes.
bright spot comes in the shape of Phelps, Michael Phelps.
Were you going to leave us in suspense there, Femi?
Yeah, I'll tell you later. After winning his 11th career gold medal, he racked up wins and records in the 200-metre butterfly and 800-metre freestyle. Congratulations to him.
All thanks, right. Femi.
You're
thanks.
Welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry. Now, earlier this morning, we were talking about a presidential playlist. Both John McCain and Barack Obama have come up with their top 10 favorite songs. We'd like to know what your playlists would be for the candidates. So let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We are also talking about the Declaration of Independence. Does it include the pursuit of French fries? Coast to coast, there's a crackdown on indulgence. We have mandatory calorie count postings in New York. In L.A., now a ban on fast food joints in particular neighborhoods. To find out more, we go to New York Times food writer Kim Severson. Kim, what's going on in L.A.?
Well, the problem in L.A. is there's a lot of fast food restaurants and not a lot of grocery stores in a particular part of South Los Angeles. So the city council decided they would put a moratorium on new fast food restaurants for about a year, although it probably will extend a bit. And the idea is to try to assemble some parcels of land and entice some grocery stores to come in so that people have different kinds of food choices. Right now, about 45% of the restaurants, of about 900 restaurants in that area in South Central Los Angeles, are what we consider typical chain fast food drive-through restaurants. So say you live there. You know, you've got 7 minutes between going to your two jobs. You don't have a lot of money. You know, the dollar value menu is quite attractive. So the idea is to reduce obesity and all of the associated diseases that come with it to give people healthier food choices by banning fast food, essentially, for a year.
Okay. And tell us a little bit more about this neighborhood. Is it particularly...
Well, the South LA, the sort of broader definition of it, it's about 32 square miles. There's 500,000 people there. It's a very largely poor section. Sections of it are largely African American. There's some pockets of Mexican and Central South Americans, immigrants who are coming into it. And it is a place in which, you know, if somebody's going to open a drive-through in a neighborhood there, the community council is not necessarily going to get up in arms like it might, say, in, you know, Montclair, New Jersey. So it's, you know, people have different priorities there, different things that they've got to take care of. So basically, this is a planning decision in a lot of ways. It's an urban planning method. You know, certainly we all do things like decide, well, we want a liquor store in this neighborhood. This strip club is too close to the schools. We make value judgments on what should be built in our neighborhoods all the time. This is the first time, as far as my research has shown, that they've done it in relation to calories, obesity, food.
That's what I was going to say. I mean, this is really an experiment that many people across the country, both public policy advocates as well as, you know, health advocates and politicians, are going to be taking a look at to see how it works. Has there been challenges to it in terms of the legality of it, or was the restaurant associations, were they involved in the planning on how LA adopted this rule?
Well, obviously the restaurant association doesn't like this sort of thing, and I don't know if you all recall in 2003, I think, when people were suing trying to sue McDonald's for making them fat. And actually, there have been some state laws that have been enacted since that prevent obese people from suing the people who have prepared the food for them. So the Restaurant Association obviously doesn't like this kind of thing. You know, the idea is, you know, fast food doesn't kill people. People kill people, or whatever the version of that would be. So they, I think they did get involved in writing some of the real specific language around what defines a fast food restaurant in these cases. You know, the Restaurant Association, I think, sees the writing on the wall when it comes to the obesity crisis. Surgeon General in 2001 declared obesity an epidemic. Since then, public health officials have thrown everything they can at the problem. They've tried all sorts of things. We've seen a lot of it here in New York City.
I was just going to say the posting of the calorie counts at restaurants that have a certain number of units here in the city. I mean, what a huge change.
That's having an effect. I personally have made some different choices when I've seen those calorie counts.
I think it totally works. I mean, when you see a donut 1,000 calories or mm-hmm. a muffin 400 mm-hmm. calories, it makes you think twice about what you're going to eat.
Certainly makes you appreciate the small order of fries in a new way, I think. You know, and that calorie count is a very interesting thing. It's happening. Portland, Multnomah counties passed one. Other counties and cities in California have passed it. The Restaurant Association really doesn't think that posting, mandatory calorie posting, is a good idea. They've come up with some alternatives, and they're actually considering proposing a national standard for nutrition information on, that's sort of like on the packages of your food. And I talk in my story today in the Times about you know, this idea that if the nutrition information is on tray liners or brochures, National Restaurant Association thinks that would be a fine alternative.
Yeah, I want to interject before we wrap up here. Even if you ban an increase in the number of fast food restaurants, and even if you cajole a grocery, for instance, into that particular neighborhood in L.A., who's to say that someone's going to be able to afford the fruits, vegetables, and lean protein that they're supposed to eat as compared to that dollar meal you were talking about?
Well, it's an interesting subject. And, you know, we all look at the things we spend money on. This is a value judgment, but, you know, maybe you spend $4 on a cup of warm milk with some espresso in it, and you're just, you know, you think that extra money on organic tomatoes is too much. So, you know, I think it's tough to decide what people are going to spend their money on, but, you know, it's a tough call.
Hey, Kim, we're going to ask you to stick around because a little later we're going to go to your other area of expertise, and that would be softball.
The game of summer.
Okay. Kim Severson is a writer for The New York Times. And now, headlines with Femi Oke.
Thanks, Catherine. Just coming up to 20 minutes to the hour. Just getting in some retail figures from the Commerce Department. And the government says that retail sales fell in July. Retail sales dipped to 0.1% last month. France brokered a peace deal between Russia and Georgia less than 24 hours ago, but the crisis isn't over. Georgian officials say that Russian tanks have occupied the Georgian city of Gori, where eyewitnesses have reported looting and bombing. Russia is denying the accusations. A roadside bomb ripped through a busy street in northern Lebanon this morning. The blast killed 18 people and wounded 40 others. Some local media suspect al-Qaeda-linked militants. Others say the attack is designed to disrupt Lebanese negotiations to repair relations with Syria. In the Iraqi city of Kirkuk today, a suicide bomber blew up a truck near a convoy that was taking the mayor to work. The mayor, along with several bodyguards, was injured in the explosion. And in the northern city of Mosul, a car bomb at a local market has killed at least 2 people and wounded 5 others. Let's just take a break from all the mayhem and give you this little bite here. The man who discovered the Beatles, his name was Brian Epstein.
I hadn't had anything to do with pop management of pop artists before that day that I went down to the Cavern Club and heard the Beatles playing.
That was the Beatles manager, Brian Epstein. People for years were trying to get the Beatles contract off him, and now you can actually buy it for yourself. Signed back in 1962, it goes on sale at the beginning of September, expected to fetch $500,000.
Boy, and for a guy who had never been involved with pop
a pop
groups,
beat combo,
he did okay
never done that
coming
before.
Up with the Beatles. Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning, I'm Adora Udoji, and you're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry. We're going to turn now to Gabriel Gatehouse. He is a BBC correspondent who is reporting to us live from Tbilisi. You might have known that we have some moving news reports this morning saying that Russian tanks are moving even further into Georgia, in fact, are on the road to Tbilisi. Gabriel, what's going on there?
Well, I can tell you that a BBC colleague of mine who was near the town of Gori, which is close to the de facto border with South Ossetia, saw around 60 Russian armoured vehicles, including tanks and armoured personnel carriers, moving through that town, which is within Georgian territory, and getting onto the road which heads south towards Tbilisi. My colleagues then went south along that road themselves for about 15 minutes, whereupon they came upon a Georgian checkpoint which had around 20 Georgian military vehicles in it. Now that's the freshest information I can give you. From that I would deduce that there is a Russian force within Georgia at the moment about 15 minutes away from from a number of Georgian army vehicles. I should say that we've just had this information through from our Moscow bureau. A Kremlin source there has denied that any Russian troops are headed for Tbilisi.
Well, in fact, Gabriel, one of my questions is, are they making a distinction between Russian troops and the troops of South Ossetia?
Yes, I think these are specifically Russian troops that we're talking about here. They're a mixture of peacekeepers and troops that have been sent in during the latest incidents of fighting. So I think we're talking about Russian troops here, not South Ossetian.
All right. And also, President Saakashvili of Georgia has been on CNN now for something like 17 minutes. And among the things he's saying is that they will defend, of course, the capital of Georgia, Tbilisi. How much danger is Tbilisi in, do you think? How much danger are you in?
Well, it's difficult to tell. This town has come under a few airstrikes over the past few days. There hasn't been much damage in the capital, unlike in some other parts, notably that town of Gori, and then, of course, the town of Trinvali, the capital of South Ossetia, came under very heavy bombardment. It's hard to tell. Again, the Kremlin is saying that it's not headed for Tbilisi. The Georgian government seems to think they are. They've been saying for the past while that they are ready to defend the capital. I have to say 2 days ago I was part of a witness to a flight by the Georgian army from Gori southwards towards Tbilisi. It was very chaotic. There were all kinds of Georgian army vehicles heading southwards with almost no command structure whatsoever. Soldiers in all kinds of civilian vehicles also heading south in a panicked fashion. I saw armored personnel carriers dragging pieces of artillery down a civilian motorway. So it's hard to say what kind of order the Georgian military is in at the moment.
Okay, Gabriel, very, very quickly, succinctly, what are you hearing from the people of Gori? Excuse me, what are you hearing from the people of Tbilisi?
The people in Tbilisi, I would say the mood here this morning when I went around the market was somber but defiant. It's a day of mourning here. This was before we heard the news that troops might be heading south. It's a day of mourning here for what the government says is 175 of their citizens dead, but also defiant in the face of what they
Thank
see
you.
As Russian aggression.
Gabriel Gatehouse, BBC correspondent, speaking to us from Tbilisi, Georgia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry. Blender Magazine has created top 10 playlists for both Barack Obama and John McCain, and we're asking you this morning to help us make our own playlist for the candidates. Now, some of you had one song for each.
This is Matt Chauncey, in from New Hampshire, from the Godfather of Soul, the world's greatest entertainer, James Brown. It's a man's, man's world, would be John Senator McCain's selection.
This is a man's world!
And for Senator Obama, say it loud.
Say it loud. Say it loud.
Okay, you can share your song and say it loud at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And now we're going to go to Femi Okeh in the news.
Thanks very much, Catherine. It is 12 minutes to the hour. The government says that retail sales fell in July, the weakest performance in 5 months. It's a worse showing than economists have been expecting. The Commerce Department reported that retail sales dipped 0.1% last month. Russia is denying Georgian claims that the Russian tanks are moving into the Georgian city of Gori, just hours after the two countries reached a peace agreement. A top Georgian security official says the Russians are bombing and looting inside Gori. Afghan militants ambushed a U.S.-based organization's vehicle south of Kabul today, leaving an American aid worker dead, along with her two colleagues and their Afghan driver. All four were shot several times, according to an Afghan doctor. The federal government says it's putting a temporary stop on new licenses for bus companies. The announcement follows last week's deadly Texas bus crash that accident killed 17 people and drew attention to loose regulations on U.S. bus companies. Have a listen to this. More people watched this than any other TV show last week.
What in the world?
I was going to
say. The Summer Olympic Games.
It's Olympic Idol.
Yeah.
I love that show.
Top the Nielsen ratings for TV. And I'll play a little bit of that as I talk about Michael Phelps. He's done it again, racked up gold medals 10 and 11 earlier on today. And that earns him the title of the most successful Olympian ever. And just a little note from a team that's actually departing from the Olympics. The U.S. Olympic softball team picked up another win. They're celebrating their 3-0 win over Australia. And appropriately, the crowd goes wild.
That was perfect timing, Femi.
She's slick.
Thank you so much. Still with us, Kim Severson, New York Times food writer. She's a big softball fan, right, Kim?
Oh, I am. I have played softball for many years in many places, and snowshoe softball in Alaska, and media softball in Central Park in New York. And in my younger days, a little more competitive, but I am a big softball fan.
A big dedicated one,
wow.
Clearly. And Catherine, how about you? You
I was
ever
just
been out on
say,
the mound?
Would you like the other end of the spectrum? Just call me one inning Lanfer.
So you play a lot of right field.
No, center field. Had to play it as a kid. There was a rule you had to play one inning, and I became very religious. Dear God, don't let the ball come my way.
Well, there are lots of people out there who enjoy it much more like Kim and a lot less like Catherine. And so it's a good day for them that the U.S. women's softball team won its 16th straight, as Femi just told us, beating Australia 3-0. But it's really a bittersweet time for women's softball fans. The China Games will mark the end of the sport at the Olympics because the International Olympics Committee cut it from the 2012 Games. Now, that's a terrible disappointment for the next generation who had big dreams, players like Lindsay Callanan, who plays first base for the Lake County Liberty softball team in Illinois, and Emily Ott, her teammate, who pitches. They both join us from outside Chicago. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So did you catch the game and this big win this morning?
No, actually. I haven't been able to see it on TV.
Oh, you have not. Well, Lindsay, let's talk about then what your reaction was to learning that the women's softball had been canceled from the 2012 Olympics.
It's really just not fair to the younger girls in across the world. Like, it's kind of crushing a lot of dreams. It might even make people not play softball anymore.
Now, Emily, you think that's true? Many moons ago, I was a pitcher, and I can say I did enjoy or have enjoyed watching women out there on the mound. What's it like for you to see these women playing in the Olympics?
I think it's really inspiring to see them play, especially at that kind of level, and just seeing them take it away. It's just really disappointing because the Olympics are an event that everyone watches, and it would just be really sad to see it not being played like every other sport out there.
Lindsay, what has the sport meant for your life?
Oh, wow, it's about half of my life, probably more than half of my life. I mean, I've been playing since I was 5, and if it was taken away from the Olympics, like, it's like heartbreaking almost.
What has the game taught you? What makes it so special? Why have you engaged in it for, I guess, more than a decade?
Well, I kind of grew up around it. My brothers played baseball, so of course I was going to play softball. But it's just taught me a lot of, like, leadership skills, and just you get to be so close to all your teammates, and I've made a lot of friends playing, and it's just my favorite thing to do by far.
And Kim Severson, from our pal from the New York Times, it certainly gained in popularity in 1996 when it first appeared, women's softball first appeared in the Olympics. There wasn't a lot of awareness about it necessarily outside of the U.S. and perhaps a bit in Europe.
Well, softball is such a universal thing. And, you know, most people have picked up on a company team or like these young women who have played competitively. And once you see competitive softball and the speed with which those pitchers play and the strategy, it's really an engaging and terrific game when it's played at the level that these Olympians are playing it.
And quick. It's very fast-paced. Okay, ladies, I'm going to give you about half a nanosecond to think, but give me your pitch for the Olympic Committee that you would make, because there will be an opportunity for folks who want to see softball to make an argument as to why they think it should come back in 2016 in the Olympics. Then what would you say if you could talk to the committee, Emily?
I would say that it's really disappointing to see that they're taking a sport away where, even though like the USA team is dominating, it doesn't mean that people aren't watching and enjoying and seeing all the skills that are being played and stuff, and that they're taking away every kid's dream to play their sport at Olympic level, and it's just sad to see them taking it away.
And Lindsay, what would you say, what reason would you give, the most important reason you think, to keep a sport that showcases women's athleticism in the Olympics?
I would have to say that softball is one of the better women's sports, and that it's just now, like, it's just getting so big now and so popular, that how, if they take it away now, it's just going to take, like, it's probably going to crush the sport, and people will probably stop playing. So, I mean, I can't imagine how big it's going to get within the next 10 years if it's getting so big so fast now.
Emily, how much softball you plan on playing this fall?
Oh, a lot. Definitely.
And Lindsay?
Yes, for sure, every day.
Well, congratulations to you, and we wish both of you all the best.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Lindsay Callanan, who plays first base and outfield for the Lake County Liberty softball team outside Chicago, and Emily Ott, her teammate. Emily is a pitcher. Thank you, and thank you also to Kim Severson, a writer for the New York Times, who joined us for part of the show today.
I'm Catherine Lamfer, in for John Hockenberry, and we are always on here at The Takeaway. You can catch up with us on Facebook, FriendFeed, Twitter.
On today's show, rumors and possibilities. Will Pakistan's President Musharraf resign tomorrow, as some Pakistani newspapers are reporting? The latest also from the conflict in Georgia.
And is eating healthily a matter of choice, or should it be mandated? Let us know what you think. Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We also, of course, are asking you to give us your presidential playlist. What songs do you want for Obama or McCain?
My song is for the Obama campaign. It's Born at the Right Time, Paul Simon's Born at the Right Time, and it goes like this. Never been lonely, never been lied to, never have to shuffle in fear, nothing denied to. Born at the instant church bells chime, and the whole world whispering, born at the right time. And the whole world whispering, born at the right time.
I love people who are bold
Good
enough
for him. Thank you
to
so
call
much
in
for that response.
With their own music and song. Thank you.
If you want to sing along, 877-8-MY-TAKE, we'll play it. I promise, probably. And here's today's takeaway.
And it was all very hush-hush. Actually, it felt like some kind of secret lodge, actually.
That was WNYC reporter Bob Henley talking about the fundraiser that John McCain was holding in all places, New Jersey. McCain folks think they may have a run there.
I know. Now, don't forget to visit our website, thetakeaway.org. You can listen to our show online. You can also sing to us. I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji, and you're listening to The Takeaway.
Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Michael Phelps picks up his fourth and fifth medals at the Olympics And the American coverage sounds like this.
Michael Phelps once again. Perfect 5 for 5 in Beijing is Phelps, the greatest Olympic champion of all time.
While in China, coverage on Phelps' winning streak sounds more like this. The Olympics. All in the ears of the beholder, it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, August 13th. Catherine Lamfer is in for John Hockenberry. Good morning, Catherine.
Hey, Adora.
Records and records and more records are being made at the Olympics. Zimbabwe power-sharing talks come to a standstill. Frank Sinatra, a point of agreement by Senator Barack Obama and Senator McCain, and a California drought causing serious consequences. Those stories are all coming up in this hour. But first, we have some headlines. Russia is denying it has broken a truce with the Republic of Georgia in the breakaway region of South Ossetia. The BBC's Gavin Hewitt is on the ground in the province. A little more than an hour ago, he said Russian troops and their South Ossetian allies were rampaging through the city of Gori.
There are still Russian tanks in the city. They seem to be dismantling and destroying Georgian army bases there. There is a pall of smoke over the market. We have heard of people being stripped of everything at gunpoint. There may well be a ceasefire, but terror has come in its wake.
Hewitt says a stream of people from smaller villages outside Gori are reporting that their homes have been torched. Russia denies that its troops have broken the truce. While the situation in Georgia remains on edge, diplomatic fallout continues following Russia's invasion of the independent state. Senior Bush administration officials say the U.S. and allies are considering kicking Russia out of the G8 group of industrialized nations.
In Afghanistan, gunmen have shot to death 3 women and an Afghan driver working for the International Rescue Committee, a U.S. aid organization. The 4 were driving to Kabul when they were ambushed. No one has claimed responsibility yet for a roadside bomb that tore through morning rush hour traffic in the Lebanese capital of Tripoli. 18 people, including 7 Lebanese soldiers, were killed and 40 more wounded.
The Commerce Department says retail sales fell by 0.1% in July in numbers just released this morning. That makes it the weakest performance in 5 months. It's a worse reading than economists were expecting. There are 2 Olympic swimming heroes today, though only one of them got a gold medal, and that's Michael Phelps, who won 2 gold medals, bringing his lifetime total to a record 11 Olympic gold. Teammate Eric Shanto narrowly missed a trip to the finals in the 200-meter breaststroke. Shanto's next challenge will be in 2 weeks when he has surgery to treat his testicular cancer.
Oil prices are holding steady at around $113 a barrel in Asian trading, the Dow down just over 1% to close at 11,642, the S&P down a little over 1% opening at 1289. What would be on your presidential playlist? Find out what we're talking about. Go to My Take at thetakeaway.org or go ahead, croon us a tune at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, folks. Want to remind you that today Catherine Lampner is with us, sitting in for John. And this morning we're going to start with South Africa, where there are some conflicting reports suggesting that perhaps President Robert Mugabe, who's held on to power for more than 25 years, has come to a power-sharing deal with one segment of the opposition party. But South African President Thabo Mbeki, who's mediating the talks, insisted on South African radio that the negotiations are still in progress. These negotiations, the result of Zimbabweans voting in March, and there being a runoff and violence following leading up to the runoff and international intervention. So let's go to Jonah Fisher, who's a BBC correspondent in Johannesburg, South Africa, for the very latest. Hi there, Jonah. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. It's a mess, isn't it?
It just is. This is a story that consistently changes on a day-to-day basis. What have you found in your reporting to this point?
Well, it's really a case of trying to unpick the spin which all the parties seem to be trying to impart in what's now looking increasingly like a failed attempt at resolving Zimbabwe's political problems. The talks effectively broke down late last night in Harare, and then we had various people who'd been involved in the talks trying to put their own perspective on what had happened. We were hearing from ZANU-PF, which is Robert Mugabe's party, the president of Zimbabwe, that they were looking into a deal with a minority faction of the Movement for Democratic Change. These talks haven't just been about ZANU-PF and the Movement for Democratic Change. There's also a smaller splinter group, much smaller, led by a chap called Professor Arthur Mutambara. Now, he appears to be much more willing to strike a deal with Robert Mugabe than the man who leads the big faction of the MDC, Morgan Tsvangirai.
So Jonah, let me interject there. The idea of that kind of boggles the mind, given the fact that Mutambara's party has been such a small player in what's gone on since March when the voting began in Zimbabwe. It was not Mutambara who was the one who got at least 50% of the vote, as Morgan Tsvangirai did. So what position could he possibly have been in to cut any kind of deal with Robert Mugabe?
Well, now, on a purely mathematical level, if you look at the way the parliamentary election went in March of this year, which was perhaps not entirely fair, but at least all the sides competed in it, Robert Mugabe's party, ZANU-PF, got 99 seats. The opposition, MDC, got 100 seats. And Arthur Mutambara got 10 seats. So what Robert Mugabe could perhaps argue is, well, if you put together our seats and the seats of Arthur Mutambara, we've got a majority. But everyone basically acknowledges that this deal, there will be no really working deal in Zimbabwe without the larger faction of the MDC on board, Morgan Tsvangirai's party, because the only thing which really is going to get Zimbabwe back on track economically is if they receive large amounts of aid from both surrounding countries and from the West. And the West has made it pretty clear that the deal which has got to be struck eventually has to be a credible deal, and it has to involve Morgan Tsvangirai in a really significant position.
So where does that leave all of the parties today?
Well, we're really waiting to hear. Most of them are planning to hold press conferences this afternoon in Harare, when they will put their own perspectives on what happened at the talks. The talks themselves are finished. President Mbeki, the mediator from South Africa, who's just spent three long days in Harare trying to bang heads together, he's now moved on to Angola, and he's got a summit to prepare for this weekend. So this phase is effectively over. Everyone's talking up the prospects of them coming back at some unspecified point, but it's fairly clear that no real working deal was found here, and that it was simply a question that Robert Mugabe wasn't willing to give enough to Morgan Tsvangirai to make any deal work.
Okay, Jonah Fisher, thanks for that.
Thanks.
Jonah Fisher reporting in South Africa for the BBC.
So where does that leave us?
I think, as he said, it can be very messy, and we have to be very patient.
All right. And, of course, we're going to keep following that. Meanwhile, we're moving on to this story. British Petroleum closed two pipelines in Georgia in the wake of the conflict with Russia. One carried Caspian oil from Azerbaijan to the Georgian Sea. Another British Petroleum pipeline stopped last week as well, following an explosion on a portion of its line. Now, these are key energy routes. And to find out more, we're going to turn to Carola Hoyos, who is the chief energy correspondent for the Financial Times, and she is joining us from London. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello, thank you.
Now, let's start first with what didn't happen. We had two major pipelines closed in Georgia, and oil prices did not spike up. So what does that mean?
That's kind of good news for drivers in the US and also in Europe. It means that really the sentiment has shifted quite dramatically in the last month. Oil prices have fallen 24% in the last month. And, you know, we talked about a month ago, and pretty much any threat to even a much smaller pipeline than the BTC pipeline that runs almost a million barrels a day of crude oil into a very serious and important hub would have increased the price quite dramatically. Now, just 4 weeks later, we are feeling far more comfortable about how much supply we've got on the market. And you see that in the fact that the oil prices continue to fall, despite the fact that this very key route has been shut for a while and two smaller pipelines were shut yesterday.
Oh, so now talk about how big this move is. When is the last time something like this has happened?
Well, I was scratching my head about this. I've covered this for quite a long time, and this happens relatively rarely. BP has been burned before on pipelines, and they did. Do you remember they shut down the Alaska pipeline a couple of years ago, pretty much as a precaution because it was leaking in small points, and that affected the oil price, and people were a bit surprised that, that BP was willing to go to that extreme measure. So I think the recent history of BP has informed this decision to a certain degree, but generally, even during the Iraq-Iran war and during the Gulf wars that followed that war, the industry has been incredibly resourceful at keeping the spigots open and pipelines or ships and tankers moving.
Now, if we could go back and explain the importance of these two pipelines. We keep talking about how they're key routes, but where are they and what do they mean, really?
Well, they're very important because they are not in the Middle East, or the oil that they carry is not from the Middle East, and they are not in Russia. So strategically, they're very important to Europe in terms of diversifying its supply away from those two key suppliers that they are so dependent on, both for oil and in terms of Russia for oil and gas. And they're also important enough for the U.S. from a strategic perspective that the U.S. was absolutely key in getting the BTC pipeline, which is that big pipeline that was shut earlier this month, going. So they are strategically, because of where they are, very important to Europe and the U.S., but also to Russia.
And now, Carola, this is Adora. You and I spoke last month about how all of these international events, small ones, were having such a big impact on world oil prices. Do you think the vulnerability has been mitigated by the strength of the U.S. dollar and also by the decreasing of U.S. demand? What's making the oil price less volatile this week, given international events?
Well, you're absolutely right to ask that question, and your second point is the more important one. It's that the demand from the U.S. has really come off because you've had two problems. One, you've had high gasoline prices at the pump, and people aren't willing to pay $4 plus per gallon. And two, you've had a credit crunch and a slowing economy, which makes people feel poorer. So they're doing two things. They're not driving as much on their summer holiday, and they're also starting to move towards buying Japanese small, efficient cars and trading in their SUVs. That second shift is a structural shift, and that's very important because it looks like that is not going to, they're not going to revert back to SUVs that quickly, even when the oil price falls as it has been doing. So really, the big things that have happened is that demand has come off in the U.S. and supply has come on. The last time we talked about the meeting in Jeddah where the Saudis promised to add more oil, and they have. We had a piece in the FT in today's paper that OPEC is pumping more oil than it ever has, and that's in part thanks to the Saudis who promised to increase, and they did, not to the level that they promised, but nonetheless they did increase their output because they were coming under pressure from the high oil prices. And that has brought prices from $147 a barrel to $116.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Carola Hoyos, Chief Energy Correspondent for the Financial Times, thanks again. And of course, Adora, we have other news coming out of Georgia. The President Saakashvili, the President of Georgia, says the truce is totally broken there. He thinks Russian troops are headed on their way to Tbilisi, the Georgian capital. We just now, CNN is reporting that the Russian General Staff said, no, the troops aren't headed there. It's hard to keep track of it all.
We'll get an update from Femi Aoki shortly.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, August 13th, and I'm joined today by Catherine Lamper, who is in for John Hockenberry. And we've been talking, Catherine, about songs
yes.
that Barack Obama and John McCain like as a result of something that came out in Blender magazine. So, of course, that's meant we've asked you about a presidential playlist.
My name is Reggie from Atlanta. For Barack Obama, I think A Brand New Day.
And that's a song by Sting. What's your song for John McCain or Barack Obama? Call us, and or maybe even call us and sing it to us at 877-8.
Oh, no.
My Take. Catherine?
We're asking people to sing to us?
Why not?
Oh, all right, all right. Hey, now you've been following Michael Phelps. How can you help it, right?
Sure.
With all the coverage we have going on, he's set the gold standard. Let's see. Just this morning, he won the 200-meter butterfly. He was part of the 800-meter freestyle relay team. He was. That's five golds, five events, three to go. I can barely keep track of all this. 11 career gold medals. It's the most of any Olympic athlete. It's amazing. And you cannot escape his face, his achievements, the sound of him in the water. Unless, of course, you're in China. We're going to go now to Beijing. Jerry Longman from the New York Times has been noticing a strange sort of silence over there. Hey, Jerry, thanks for joining us again.
Sure, thank you.
Now, tell me, what kind of media coverage in China is Michael Phelps getting?
It's a kind of muffled coverage. He, for instance, he set a world record on Tuesday, and in Wednesday's leading sports daily, he made page 32 of the top sports daily newspaper. He was on page 30 of another paper, and in one of the leading state-run newspapers that basically only the intellectuals read, they didn't make a mention of him. So,
well, let's be fair. Let's be fair, Jerry. Yeah. They've got a big event. They got a lot going on. There was the
right.
gymnastics team.
Now, clearly, I mean, you know, predictably, the Chinese media would focus on many of the Chinese athletes. But swimming here is not a very popular sport. The Chinese women have faded after being involved in a series of doping scandals in the 90s. And Sunday was the first time a Chinese man ever won a swimming medal. So it's clearly not a big sport. Also, the NBA has made huge inroads here. So Kobe Bryant, LeBron James are much more popular athletes. You know, the Olympics are kind of an engaging novelty every 4 years, but the NBA is always here, and those are the more famous athletes. But there's another issue that could be at play here.
Mm-hmm.
Susan Brownell, an American Fulbright scholar from St. Louis who is studying here at Beijing Sport University, said that one of her colleagues had posted an innocuous web posting at the end of last year or early this year, just saying, you know, Michael Phelps is looking to win 8 gold medals to break Mark Spitz's record, and that the ultra-nationalist response was so vehement they ended up having to take the posting down, and that Susan Brownell wonders whether there's some sort of editorial decision being made to, you know, this is a great moment for China. China's doing well, and let's not. And they're sensitive to the idea of this nationalistic backlash. So she thinks maybe an editorial decision has been made to downplay Phelps for fear that this ultra-nationalist response would look very ugly, you know, while China is hosting the games.
Wow, it's so funny to think that they think the accomplishments of one person could overshadow an entire country.
Well, some people are sensitive, equating, you know, by saying that oh, you're saying that the United States is better than China, and so they're in a way that probably, you know, wouldn't happen in the United States. So That's you know, it's hard to know whether that's accurate or not, but at least that's one theory from an American professor living here.
I also couldn't help but think that when you compare, say, badminton and how it's covered in China compared to how it's covered in this country, perhaps we're doing the same thing.
Right. You know, to be honest, I just lost your train of thought. One of my editors just screamed at me. Just please say again, you know, sorry, this is live radio, but, you know, we're right on deadline here, 24 hours a day.
I was going to say, and I know that you are still working on this story even as we speak, and it hasn't been filed yet. So we appreciate your time here. What I was going to say, what I said was that when you could also look at this from a different angle, which is that, as I recall, badminton is a huge sport in China. They know our American badminton players by name, whereas I could not name one of our badminton players.
No, right. And I mean, this is sort of the equivalent of, you know, a Chinese sort of judoist winning 8 gold medals in the Olympics in Atlanta. We wouldn't pay that much attention to it, obviously. So it's, you know, it's, I mean, it's fair to say, you know, it's, you would expect the Chinese to be paying much more attention to other athletes. But it is kind of funny, given the saturation coverage in the U.S., how different it is here.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, Phelps said he got a text message right before his race this morning from a high school buddy who said, dude, do you know how many times a day I have to look at your ugly face? And so that, you know, and Phelps, I don't think, is too broken up about it. And,
yeah, I was going to say, it isn't like the poor boy's being ignored. All right, Jerry, I'm very sensitive to people getting yelled at by their editors, so I'm going to release you. But you come back and talk to us again, all right?
Surely will. Thank you very much.
Okay. That's Jerry Longman from the New York Times. Ah, and now we're going to turn to Femi Okeh from The Takeaway.
Thanks very much, Catherine. 28 minutes past the hour. Less than a day after it was struck, a truce between Russia and the Soviet Republic of Georgia appears to be in ruins. The BBC reports that Russian troops and their South Ossetian allies are rampaging through the breakaway province of South Ossetia. Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili says there is no ceasefire. That's quite difficult to keep up with the events in the Republic of Georgia. Mm. But Georgia says it's under attack. Russia issues denials, and this has been going on all morning. In an interview this morning on CNN, President Saakashvili described what he says Russian troops are doing in Georgia.
They are rampaging through cities, villages and towns. There, we have a humanitarian disaster attempt. We have 180,000 internally displaced persons. They are going through villages, killing people, rampaging people, you know, destroying, blowing up houses.
Russia denies that it has broken the truce and its troops are not marching to the Georgian capital. Senior Bush administration officials say that the U.S. and allies are considering kicking Russia out of the G8 group of industrialized nations. The U.S. has come down firmly on the side of Georgia after Russia invaded the independent state. The Commerce Department says that retail sales fell in July to turn in their weakest performance in 5 months. Retail sales dipped 0.1% last month. That's their first decline since sales fell by 0.5% in February. Americans fed up with gas prices drove 12.2 billion fewer miles in June than the same month a year earlier. The 4.7% decline is the biggest monthly driving drop in a downward trend that began in November.
Wow. Almost 5% in a year?
That's amazing.
That's extraordinary.
It's a lot of mileage, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Shows
Absolutely.
It can be done.
Thanks very much, Femi.
You're very welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I'm Catherine Landfer, in for John Hockenberry. Okay, Adora, we know that presidential hopefuls Barack Obama and John McCain differ on different points of U.S. policy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Iraq, solutions to the energy crisis. They even have some musical disagreements. Blender magazine polled the two of them for their top 10 favorite songs. You want to make any guesses as to who went where?
No, but it is an interesting list.
Okay.
I'm going to let you tell it.
All right. Obama went for hits, as you might expect. Bruce Springsteen, the Rolling Stones. McCain tilted toward hits by ABBA and Neil Diamond. But the lists had one thing in common.
I've got you under my skin.
That's Frank Sinatra. Now, that song is I've Got You Under My Skin, a Cole Porter classic as recorded by Sinatra. That's the number 8 song on a John McCain list of top 10 hits. And the blue side of this disc?
That you can't see your future with me, 'cause you'd be, oh, so easy to love.
That's another Cole Porter tune, also recorded by Sinatra. You'd Be So Easy to Love. And that comes in at number 7 on the Barack Obama list. Old Blue Eyes as the bridge between red states and blue states? Who knew? Well, actually, we're guessing that jazz musician John Pizzarelli probably did. He's had the privilege of opening for Sinatra numerous times, and he has a new CD coming out later this month, August 19th, called With a Song in My Heart. And he joins us on the line now. Hey, John, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. How you doing?
I'm all right. Okay, what does it say that given all the other disparities on their lists, I mean, really, ABBA versus Bruce Springsteen? What does it say that they both like Sinatra?
Well, I guess they realize there's Sinatra fans all over the United States, so they got to throw in, at least they'll get the Italian vote.
Now, really, seriously, what is it about Sinatra that would appeal across party lines, as it were?
I think Sinatra, being that his career spanned 6 decades, there's so many people that have their favorite Sinatra song, so there's always some sort of Sinatra in everybody's form of reference. Even though there's no Beatles songs on their list, but there's Sinatra songs that shows that Sinatra's, you know, ubiquitous over the past 6 decades.
What about the fact that both of these songs are Sinatra interpretations of Cole Porter?
I find that interesting. I think that the song I've Got You Under My Skin is sort of a classic, and you know anyone would pick that one. The sort of unique choice is Easy to Love. I don't know if anybody would choose Easy to Love as a song, a favorite song, much less a favorite Sinatra record. And it's You'd Be So Easy to Love. It'd be more interesting, I guess, if I'd Be So Easy to Love. You know, it might work better for him.
Yeah. Now, what Sinatra songs then would you have picked out if you have some quibbles?
Well, I think as I was thinking about it, I think earlier I thought Wee Small Hours would be an obvious choice, but, maybe Obama would choose My Kind of Town, Chicago Is, and get the hometown vote. And then there is a record of By the Time I Get to Phoenix, and John McCain could choose that, so at least they could cover the hometown vote.
Yeah, you're going for some pretty cornball lists here, I got to tell you, mister. Now, you know, we actually put this question out to everyone, and that is, what song choices would you make for John McCain and Barack Obama? We're going to make you the musical advisor to the president. So go ahead, send us your own playlist, or better yet, sing it to us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. All right, we've already got some in here, John and Adora. Do you want to go ahead and take a listen?
Sure.
All right, let's hear.
John from Dartmouth, Mass. One song for each campaign. For John McCain, Under Pressure by Freddie Mercury and David Bowie. For Barack Obama, It's a Wonderful World by Louis Armstrong. Thank you.
And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Well, who couldn't like that song?
I think that one's even on John McCain's list.
I think you're right. Let's hear another one.
Hi, my name is Brian from Everett, Washington, and my recommendation for a song, maybe not for Obama, but for the convention, is Get Out of Denver by Bob Seger. How about that?
That's rather harsh.
Get
All right, we've got to do this next one. You hang on to this, John.
Okay. This is Matt Chauncey, in from New Hampshire, from the Godfather of Soul, the world's greatest entertainer, James Brown. It's a man's man's world would be John Senator McCain's selection.
This is a man's world.
And for Senator Obama, say it loud.
Okay.
Those are pretty creative.
I was just going to say, what do you think, John?
Those two are pretty good. He thought that one out pretty well. I think Say It Loud might be on Obama's list, too. I think one of those is out there. But those are two good choices.
All right. Well, now that we have the blessing of your musical advice, I want to let you go. But thank you so much, John Pizzarelli.
My pleasure. Have a great day.
Thanks. All right. That is our friend of Sinatra, acclaimed jazz vocalist and guitarist. His latest CD is With a Song in My Heart. Don't forget, we want your take on this. 877-8 My Take. And now for a take on the news, we're going to go to Femi, okay?
Thanks, Catherine. Just coming up to 20 minutes to the top of the hour. The BBC is reporting that Russian troops and their South Ossetian allies are rampaging through this key city in a breakaway province of South Ossetia. BBC correspondent Gavin Hewitt reported from the outskirts of the city of Gori just an hour or two ago.
We've spoken to so many terrified people who talk about running from their houses, turning around and seeing them being torched. And these are people giving first-hand accounts. And I can tell you, when you look into their faces and you hear their stories, you know they're telling you what they lived through.
Russia says it has not broken the truce and its troops are not advancing on the Georgian capital. The White House Press Secretary Dana Perino says that the Bush administration is monitoring the situation in Georgia. She says that President Bush is planning to make a statement from the Rose Garden about the latest developments within the next 2 hours. Militants armed with assault rifles ambushed a U.S. aid organization's vehicle south of Kabul today, killing three female aid workers and their Afghan driver. A doctor says that all four bodies were riddled with bullet wounds. 23 aid workers have been killed in Afghanistan this year. And finally, the government says that retail sales fell in July. It's the first decline since February, and it's a worse showing than economists were expecting. The Commerce Department says that the huge drop in auto sales is behind the disappointing numbers. And that's a look at your news, international and domestic.
Thanks so much. I thought those stimulus checks were supposed to help there.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
I'm Catherine Lanfer in for John Hockenberry here at The Takeaway.
And we're talking about weather, something many people are obsessed with no matter where you live in the world. And in Beijing, it has taken on some greater significance as the Olympics got underway. They were very concerned about the Olympics. And as with everything else in Beijing, the government was trying to tightly control things. And in the case of clearing smog and keeping the rain away, they are putting they're saying that 1,100 rockets did the job.
Now,
Catherine,
there's some artillery.
That they shot those rockets up, and boy, it kept the rain away. But
rain dispersal rockets.
Should those rockets get the credit? Marshall Shepard is a University of Georgia meteorologist and professor. He's joining us from outside Atlanta. Professor Shepard, do those rockets work?
Well, you know, I think it'll take some time to know conclusively whether the onslaught, if you will, on the weather by the Chinese was effective in altering the weather. This has been a longstanding scientific issue and debate over the last several decades on how conclusive or statistically significant weather modification and cloud seeding really can be.
And this is not some newfangled technology. It's actually been around since the 1940s. You want to sort of explain to us what these rockets, what's in them, and what they are hoped to do?
Well, back in the 1940s, some scientists were discovering that silver iodide and dry ice and the like might be able to simulate the seeds, the natural seeds that are needed to form precipitation, even in the natural environment, cloud processes and eventually precipitation have their humble beginnings on condensation nuclei, whether they're things like pieces of dust or clay. And one of the things that we've discovered over time is things like silver iodide can actually replicate or simulate natural seeds that need to form ice crystals that eventually fall as rain, even in the middle of the summertime here in Georgia or in New York.
It sounds kind of wacky.
Well, it's very nature, if you think about it, it may be wacky, but and I think what this whole issue of cloud seeding and weather modification, one of the things that has really been interesting is that the claims have been ridiculous on both sides. There have been outlandish claims about the success of cloud seeding, weather modification, and then there have been complete skeptics that have completely blown it off. And I think, just like with the global warming carbon dioxide debate, I think that the answer is really somewhere in the middle. If you look at reputable bodies like the American Meteorological Society, the World Meteorological Organization, and even a recent National Research Council report, there is some suggestion that under the proper conditions, cloud seeding can be effective, but some of the outlandish claims that I've seen over time, that's really where it starts to freak people out.
And in China, are they making outlandish claims quickly? Because I got to ask you about Scooby-Doo.
Well, interestingly enough, the Chinese spend about $60 million a year on this weather modification program, and UC claims that they're altering rainfall by as much as 10 to 30%. Unfortunately, many of these studies have not been published in the scientific literature,
so it's essentially unclear, is what you're saying.
It is unclear on their particular contribution, although I wouldn't completely write off that there is a possibility that they could affect it. And we are doing it here in the U.S., out in the western states as well.
Marshall Shepard, we're going to have to leave it there, and we're not going to make it to Scooby-Doo. Marshall okay. Shepard is a University of Georgia meteorologist and professor. Thanks.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, and it's August 13th, and we turn now to Femi Oke for the very latest headlines at this hour. Femi?
Thanks, Adora. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. A half day after Russia and Georgia reached a tentative peace agreement, eyewitnesses near the Georgian city of Gori are reporting looting and violence. Fleeing residents say that South Ossetian fighters are robbing people at gunpoint and setting houses on fire. The Bush administration is consulting with other world leaders, deciding how to best express fierce condemnation of Russia's military operations inside the Republic of Georgia. President Bush will be due to make a speech within the next 2 hours. And we have more coming up on Russia's role in the crisis in Georgia in just a moment or two with the New York Times in Moscow. Meanwhile, in northern Lebanon this morning, a roadside bomb exploded on a busy street during rush hour. The blast destroyed a bus, killing 11 people and wounding 40 others. Afghan officials say militants have attacked aid workers south of Kabul. The ambush killed one American, one Canadian, and one Irish national. All of them were women. They worked for the US-based International Rescue Committee. Not much fun in today's news, but Michael Phelps and the Olympic swimming team are definitely celebrating. He could add 3 more to his current count of 11 gold medals later this week when he swims in 3 more events. The record for most golds in one Olympics is 7, and Phelps already has 5. That's a look at your news, international and domestic.
Oh, thank you, Femi.
Many thanks.
We,
I think we're moving on to Russia now.
In the very latest,
we have several guests who are going to speak to us about what's happening. Catherine?
Okay. We are hoping to connect with Ellen Berry. She is She is here. This is wonderful. Ellen Berry, New York Times reporter, joining us from Moscow. Ellen, we are hearing conflicting reports. The Russians say that they have no action with their troops inside Georgia, and everyone from the Georgian president to reporters on the ground are saying, yes, they have been through Gori and they're on their way to Tbilisi. What's going on?
We do not have confirmation of tanks on their way to Tbilisi at this time. We do have reporters who are all over Georgia who have encountered a Russian presence in various places, including the western area and also Gori and the area around South Ossetia.
And what is the reaction that you're hearing in Russia?
Unfortunately, I have been mostly following events in Georgia, so I don't have a good grasp of that, although if you want to talk to some colleagues, I'm sure they do.
No, that's quite all right. But I was under the impression you were in Moscow, so I was wondering, expecting to hear from President Bush later today in the Rose Garden. This has to be complicating. Well, this is for complicating relations between Russia and the United States.
I think that's absolutely true, and I think as this situation plays out, I think that's going to be one of the long-term implications of what damage this has done to the relationship of the U.S. and Russia. I think there had been very close ties, sort of political and economic, between the U.S. and Saakashvili, and the question is whether how much the U.S. had been in the loop. My impression is that U.S. officials were quite taken aback by Mr. Saakashvili's decision.
And, Ellen, there just seems to be so much confusion. The last 5 days, nothing but confusion about what is or isn't happening in the breakaway provinces, what is or isn't happening in Georgia, and what the Russian response has been. What would be your best description of what you've learned is happening today?
Well, I think you have to be quite cautious because the fog of war is very much in effect. It's also important to point out that while there are Russian and Georgian armies involved, there are also a large number of irregulars who may not necessarily be taking their orders from anyone at all. So, that said, there have been disturbing reports today from, for example, Human Rights Watch, which reports that there are ethnic Georgian villages that were burning today from fires set by militias from South Ossetia. They saw looting, and the destruction of villages, basically.
And certainly likely to hear a whole lot more about that. As you said, it is the fog of war, and during those times, information can be hard to get by and hard to confirm. Ellen Berry, New York Times, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Ellen was coming to us from Moscow, and now we're going to go to the BBC's Russian foreign Russian affairs editor, Stephen Eek, who's been following developments from London. Thanks for being with us, Stephen.
More than welcome. Well, the latest that we have from our own reporters on the ground down in Georgia is that there is still shooting and looting going on in Gori. Gori, of course, being a Georgian town, it actually lies south of the border with South Ossetia. It's in Georgia proper. And the word we have from the reporters there is that basically the Russian military has been involved in destroying Georgian military equipment. There's been a Georgian base there, something Russia, by the way, I must say, immediately denies doing. But the television pictures that we've received from there are fairly unequivocal. They show that there is a large Russian military presence there. Now, the Georgian authorities about 2 hours ago started saying they feared the Russian military was preparing to leave Gori and to move on to Tbilisi, the Georgian capital. It appears that isn't the case, that the Russians were removing some of their hard equipment, their heavy equipment from Gori along the road that does lead towards Tbilisi, but actually left the road before carrying on any further down south towards the Georgian capital. That's what's actually happening on the ground. It is, of course, right, as we've just heard from Moscow, that there is an extremely thick fog of war. there are lots of mutual accusations still going on. And I think the most important is what the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has today said. He has again repeated this line that Russia believes the Georgian leadership ordered, quote, an act of genocide in South Ossetia. So very emotional, very heavy language still being used by the Russians. And importantly, he has said there will be no long-term solution to these problems without a review of the status of South Ossetia and another breakaway region called Abkhazia. To me, looking at it over the long term, that suggests that Russia isn't going to consider any solution that would return those territories to Georgian control.
But certainly not. But just let me stop you there, just so we could sum up the last couple of days, which is, but the problem that Russia seems to be putting forth, and we've heard it from many analysts, they're saying one thing and doing the opposite, and it's provable. So if they are saying today that their troops were not attacking in Gori and were not moving to Tbilisi, but there are actual pictures showing they are, what does that do to their credibility? What does that do to the diplomacy?
I think if you look at how governments in the former Soviet Union behave, including at times of crisis, then you shouldn't necessarily expect any of them to tell the truth. That's the hard reality. There is,
but it's also a new world, though, Stephen, isn't it? We have the internet. We have all of these pictures. These things are said and confirmed or not. And even though we are talking about the fog of war, still in a faster fashion than perhaps 20, 30 years ago, 40, 50 years ago.
That's dead right. But on the other hand, if you look at both what the Russians and the Georgians have done over the past 5 days, there have been some absolutely wild accusations. At one stage, President Saakashvili, for example, was saying that his Georgian forces had shot down 80 Russian fighter planes, and saying it in apparently all sincerity on television. The political culture that leads people to exaggerate wildly, that leads people to be dishonest, is very deeply rooted. It hasn't been completely uprooted by the internet, by 24-hour television and radio. It's important to take that into account. There is one further development inside Georgia that's very important, I think, which is that it's now been confirmed that the last Georgian forces have withdrawn from the small part of Abkhazia, the other breakaway region that they still controlled. And the Abkhaz separatist leader has said his people have been waiting for this for decades, and he's given a very clear warning to the outside world. He said Abkhazia will never again negotiate with Georgia. So important to keep an eye on what's happening there, because it appears to be defeat on a second front for the Georgian leader.
Stephen Eek, many thanks for your update once again. Stephen Eek, BBC Russian Affairs Editor, reporting to us from London.
I'm Catherine Lanford, in for John Hockenberry, reminding you that we are always on at The Takeaway. You can catch up with us on Facebook, Friend Feed, Twitter.
And here's today's takeaway.
Dude, do you know how many times a day I have to look at your ugly face?
And that was New York Times reporter Jerry Longman, who we talked to from Beijing today, and he was reporting that Michael Phelps' friends are tired of seeing him.
Okay, and don't forget, of course, we want to hear from you on The Takeaway. So make sure you check in and listen to our show. I'm Catherine Lanfer, for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji, and the question is a political playlist. What song would you give John McCain? What song would you give Barack Obama? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway,